Lord Jesus, I just thank you for today, God, and just for your blessings, and just the last week, just how awesome you've been. Lord, I thank you for the rain, even though it's kind of a pain sometimes. Lord, we need it, and I'm just so grateful that the drought is lifting, and in your provision, you've just seen, just like in the Old Testament, God, so many times your people cried out for water and for relief from the drought, God, and you answered their cries, Lord, and I thank you that you've done that for us as well. I pray that you would just bless tonight, Lord, speak through me and just have us have open minds and hearts to what you have to teach us tonight, God. Help us to retain everything that we learn. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about truth. What is truth? So the interesting thing about this question is that it's the one thing that Pilate asked Jesus when he comes face to face with him. He's like, all right, I got a chance to possibly ask God, you know, if that's who this guy is, you know, one question. What am I going to ask? You know, like it's almost like, hey, if you got in front of Jesus, you could say one thing or like ask him one, what would it be? And, you know, Pilate is like, well, what is truth? Quid est veritas? That's what he asks him. And people are still asking that question. People are still asking, what is truth? And not only what is it, but can we know it? If it is out there, do we have the ability to learn what it is? Do we have the ability to discern it for ourselves? So first we're going to talk about the nature of truth. What substance is it? What stuff is it? What is the nature of it? And then also, what is it actually? So what is the definition of truth? So first, the nature of truth. Basically, there are five views. There are four other views besides the Christian view. So first, I'm going to talk about the four views of truth that are not, that would not fall under the Christian worldview. Okay, the first one is agnosticism. Agnostics claim that truth is unknowable. We can't know truth. There's no way of discerning it. There's no way of knowing what it is. We are unable to do so. As finite individuals, we can't know what the ultimate truth of the universe is. You know, if something is transcendent, being immanent, we wouldn't be able to access it. So if there is a God, we couldn't know, basically, is what they're saying. One of the things I like about listening to Dr. Geisler is that he is always giving us these quick little tidbits on how to answer these people, because often, without even realizing it, they're committing intellectual suicide because they're making these claims, but they're not even really thinking about what kind of claim they're making. So he always says, Mr. Agnostic, is it true for you that truth is unknowable? And if so, how do you know that? Like, how do you know that truth is unknowable? And so if someone's like, oh, you can't know truth. Well, how do you know that? How do you know that you can't know truth? And so agnostics can't even use their own argument without affirming the opposite. Namely, they know one thing about truth, that you can't know it. So you know something, you know one thing, so let's start from there. And so when you do that with somebody, it's called kind of taking the roof off, so to speak, in logical terms. It basically just means that you're taking their argument and you're just taking the roof off of it. You're basically saying, look, this is what you're actually saying. Now let's reason from there. Because sometimes they don't even really think through what it means. Sometimes they're like, oh, yeah, I'm agnostic about that, or I'm agnostic. And they don't really even really understand what that position actually means.
You mean they don't believe in truth, that there is truth.
Right.
They don't.
Right.
So yeah. It's lies that they believe.
Right. Yeah. So the second one is skepticism. Skeptics say that we should doubt all truth. Be skeptical about everything. But if you're skeptical about everything, what does that include?
What they believe.
Skepticism, right? So, Mr. Skeptic, are you saying that we should be skeptical about everything, even skepticism? In the case of the skeptic, he too defeats his own argument. Basically, some say that skeptics are okay with the fact they have to remain skeptical about skepticism. They say, well, that just falls under my worldview, that I even understand that I'm skeptical about what I believe. Very few will die on this hill. They'll say, okay, yeah, I'm skeptic about stuff, but there are some things I'm pretty sure about. So they'll backtrack a little bit. No one's actually really a true skeptic when it comes down to it. But they will say, oh, well, I'm skeptical about everything, but really that means I'm just not sure if that can be true or not. Well, okay, now you're actually an agnostic. So you can kind of reason people into other positions. So you can kind of show them that, well, you're actually agnostic in this position. You're not fully skeptical, because if you were, you wouldn't believe anything at all, ever.
It seems like it's useless to argue a person like that, you know.
Well, the thing is that a lot of them don't even realize they have these positions. So that's why it's easy to actually argue them out of them. And that's what you want to do. You want to argue them out of these positions and then argue them into a position where they actually take a stand for truth. So, which we'll talk about in a second. One of the things with skeptics, if they're like, oh, I have to believe it to be skeptical about everything. Well, what's one thing that you're willing to agree you don't have to be skeptical about? Sometimes they'll say math. Sometimes they'll say like history, recorded fact. I don't have to be skeptical about that. And so if you can argue them into, well, do you believe that in the 1800s or during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president in the United States, and that was true for everybody at the time in all places at the same time, in all universes? Was that true? And if they'll say, yeah, that's true, okay, well, then you're not fully skeptical because you're willing to take a position of this was true on something. So you can pick something that almost everybody agrees on and then kind of move them into a place of truth. Postmodernism, this is a third one. These people are so fun. because it really, it's hard to nail them down. They very rarely take a position on anything. They are all over the place. There are people who will say, I'm an agnostic, I'm a skeptic, I'm an atheist, but you'll rarely get someone who's like, I'm a postmodernist. Really what it is that they're something, but you can't nail down what it is. And so they just kind of fall under the umbrella of postmodernism. Postmodernists basically avoid the whole thing by refusing to make truth claims about anything. Well, you said this about the Bible. Let's talk about that. Well, I didn't really say that. I didn't really, they kind of backpedal a lot. They say like, oh, well, I don't really mean that. Or I didn't mean it like that. Or they'll be like, that's they're very relativistic, meaning you can hold that, but I'm going to hold this, and it's all good. But if postmodernists basically say we can't claim anything is true. So there is no truth. Okay, there's no absolute truth. This is the world we live in currently, is postmodern world. But if you can't claim that anything in the entire universe is true, then obviously postmodernism would fall under that umbrella, right? You can't claim that postmodernism is true if we're not claiming anything is true. But then they'll just be like, oh, well, see, that's the beauty of postmodernism. Like, wait, what? you can get into these, you can go round and round in circles with some people, and eventually you'll just be like, okay, I have to give up at this point because they're not willing to deal with logic. And that's one of the things like with Hinduism and Buddhism, a lot of their beliefs are self-defeating, but or illogical, but they don't care. And that's where you get postmodernists. They don't care if their beliefs don't make sense. And so you've got this apathy towards logic. And so that they can be the hardest to kind of reason with, because honestly, they could just, give two cows about what you think. So
to me, those are a waste of,
Yes, I agree. You can occasionally win a couple, so that's sometimes worth it. But if you get to the point where it's not happening, then I would just say, let it go.
Waste your saliva.
Yeah. But obviously ignoring truth doesn't make it go away. So even if you ignore something, it's still going to be there. So for example, the sky is still blue, whether you choose to acknowledge it. So they can ignore stuff all they want, but it's still there. Is it Churchill? Somebody once said, you could ignore God, but it doesn't change the fact that he's there or something like that. I don't know. I have the quote later, but
it's like whether you believe or you don't, God is God.
Right. But getting them to admit that is very hard.
Oh, go what you want to do.
So the fourth one is relativism. Relativists go to the complete opposite spectrum and say, well, everything's truth. They don't say that there is none. They just say, well, everything is truth. Everybody has their own truth. It's all relative. But if the relativist is saying something is true for me, but not for them, that there's no absolute truth, well, that's an absolute statement. If you're saying there is no absolute truth, you just committed a self-defeating statement, because you're saying, you know, Mr. Relativist, are you absolutely sure there's no absolute truth? And if you're willing to admit, well, there is one truth, and that's relativism, okay, well, now we've got an absolute truth here. So then everything isn't relative. So you can kind of learn a few quick little things to kind of get them thinking in an opposite direction. What you want to do is not go after them, but just kind of ask questions that get them thinking. You know, well, if relativism is true, then is it true for everybody in all places at all times? And if that's the case, isn't that an absolute belief? You know, like, if you went to another country, for example, and you stole somebody's wallet, and their law was that they chop off your hand, like, well, are you going to be okay with that? You know, and if that's the case, then, you know, you have to basically say, well, that's their truth, so I have to agree with that. One of the examples I give is, what if you have two people and one steals from the other? The victim says, hey, give it back. I think stealing is wrong. And the thief just says, well, that's not my truth, and walks away. Can the victim do anything about it if he's a relativist? So really, you can't expect people to hold your truth position if you're a relativist. And we have a lot of this in culture today. We have a lot of people saying, everybody can believe what they want. It's all you. You decide your own truth. But the second that your truth is opposite of their truth, it becomes a problem, right? Then all of a sudden they start backpedaling. Well, wait a minute. No, your truth needs to be my truth. And so so you see a lot of hypocritical relativism in the culture we live in today, especially with things like, you know, like all the feminist women's march. It's like, well, you know, everybody, you deal what you want with your own body, but then like, well, but I don't want to pay for stuff for you. Well, but you have to. Well, wait a minute. Like, I thought we all decide our own thing here, you know, but we don't, apparently.
They seem to be deceitful people, you know, or something.
Well, it's just that they're not committed to a position.
That's why they don't come in, because they don't know anything. They are really such a kind of, they themselves are kind of, I don't know what to say, but.
Yeah, well, it's more that they don't have the commitment to something, and therefore they're all over the place.
Even if you have some evidences that, let's say, for example, hey, you did something wrong, you know. No, I didn't, you know, because I didn't believe it's wrong. Mm-hmm. For example, you killed, you robbed something, you know, but she believes, no, it's not wrong. I said.
Yeah, but then, you know, you can always appeal to the laws of land and then talk about how the laws of land are always very similar to biblical laws. And why is that the case? Why are the laws of land so similar to the Ten Commandments? You know, and then you can kind of go into that, but... But yeah, there are some very interesting ideological things happening in our culture today that have a lot to do with relativism. So then what is the Christian view of the nature of truth? So those are the four views that would not fall under the Christian worldview. But what view of the nature of truth is correct if not for the previous four? In the Baker's Encyclopedia of Christian Apologetics, Dr. Geisler says, all truth is absolute. There are no relative truths, for if something is true, then it is really true for everyone, everywhere, and for all time. So absolutism is the nature of truth that is the correct view in the Christian worldview. So some people ask, what about relative comparisons? For example, in a room that's set at 72 degrees, I say that I'm cold, but let's say Ellen says it's hot. Who is right? Is it hot or cold? How do you answer that if there's absolute truth? I say it's hot. She says it's cold. What difference, is it hot or cold? Is 72 degrees hot or cold?
Whether it's cold. The temperature is different than the other person.
Right. So, but then they'll say, see, that's a relative truth. But is it? Contrary to what some may think, it's not a relative truth. The fact that I, Sarah, am cold is true for everyone, as well as the fact that in the same room at the same time, Ellen is hot. It's really important to note that truth does not change based on our perceptions of reality. The truth is, at the time, the room is set to 72 degrees, which Sarah thinks is cold and Ellen thinks is hot. But what Sarah and Ellen think does not make the room hot or cold, or change the fact that in reality, the room is set at 72 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Right.
Everyone?
Right.
Okay. So people are...
Could you repeat?
Right. So, if you're in the room and it's at 72 degrees, and I think it's cold, and Ellen thinks it's hot, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The truth is that the room is set at 72 degrees.
Exactly.
But it's also true that for everyone in every place at all times, at that moment, Sarah thinks it's cold and Ellen thinks it's hot. But what we think doesn't change reality. The reality that it's 72 degrees.
Right.
But it's also true that that's what I think is cold, and that's what she thinks is hot. So you have to separate what's happening in the situation. It's all true. But my perception doesn't change what's actually happening.
Right, right.
But it is true for everybody that that's my perception.
Okay, is that the absolutism?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's
a truth that is true for everyone in all times, in all places. So everywhere, everyone, all at once.
If it's absolute
for all time,
to one,
sorry.
But then to others, it isn't.
Well, if it's absolute, then it is true. It's just that their perception
is not.
But because they're saying it's not true, that doesn't change that it's true.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not just by...
Right. But people will get caught up in that. They'll say, if you've got Shaq, basketball player, and you have me, well, yeah, I'm short compared to Shaq. Does that mean I'm short? Actually, compared to most women, I'm average. So, am I short or am I average? Well, that's a relative truth. Well, actually, it's not. It's a relative comparison. But the truth is that I'm 5'4". So just because you change the perception of reality...
It doesn't change
what reality actually is.
So absolutism, one more time, 72 degrees...
That's the truth. So the room is 72 degrees.
Okay.
But you can think it's hot.
4 is...
Because you feel it.
No matter what someone said, you're short. Someone said you're
right. That's a perception of the truth.
Okay.
That's not the actual truth. The actual truth is that I'm 5'4".
Mm-hmm.
But the perception is that I'm short, or that I'm average, or that I'm tall, or I could be wearing heels. That I'm tall that day. But really, I'm not that tall. So it just you can't change truth based on a perception. And one of the things in society that we have to talk to people about, we have to show them that there are perceptions of reality and that there's actual reality. What's happening in actual reality is maybe very different than someone's perception. And so we have to talk about that, and we have to make that difference. We have to show them there's a difference between what they think is real and what's actually real. So recap. One, we can know truth, and two, the nature of truth is absolute. Truth is knowable because it's. We'll talk about how you learn about it, but it is knowable, and the truth is absolute. In her book Saving Leonardo, Nancy Piercy writes, "Before Christians can make the case that Christianity is true, they first have to clarify what they mean by truth. This was the central question that I wrestled with personally when I was an agnostic. When I went to L'Abri for the first time," L'Abri is a school in Switzerland, it's Frank Schaeffer's school, "my mind was thoroughly drenched in relativism. As a result, I had to grapple with the question of whether there was a thing such as objective truth, before I could even consider whether Christianity was that truth. In his writings, Schaeffer insisted that the fracturing of truth is the most crucial problem facing Christianity today." So the thing is that a lot of times as Christians, we kind of barge into an evangelical situation and we say,
Do you know who Jesus is? Or do you read the Bible? Or do you know God? Or we start with these big theological concepts, right? We barge in and we say, here are the four spiritual laws. Well, that's great, except that the Romans Road is not going to work with someone who has no perception of truth. So if someone doesn't even believe that anything can be true, then we can't convince them that Christianity is truth until they believe that there's something such as truth. So we really have to go into each situation, assuming we don't know anything about where the other person's at, and try to figure out where they're at before we just shove the gospel down their throats. And I'm not saying that you can't meet somebody and immediately have them be ready to hear about Jesus. That's possible. But in the culture that we live in today, that's going to be rare. And 50 years ago, it wasn't. Now it is. Okay. Definition of truth. Before I give what the definition of truth is, I like to say this is what truth is not. Because we need to know not only how to discern truth, but how to discern error, right, when we read things. So Judy Salisbury, a friend of mine, she's a female apologist, she wrote a book called Reasons for Faith. And in it, she warns parents about a book that came out in 2001 entitled Conversations with God for Teens. So Neil Donald Walsh is this guy, and he wrote a book called Conversations with God. And then he wrote a book called Conversations with God for Teens. And in it, he writes, "It may be a surprise for most humans to learn that there is no such thing as right and wrong. There is only what works and what doesn't work, given what it is you are trying to do." Okay, remember, this is a book about God for teens. There is no such thing as right and wrong. There's only what works and what doesn't work, given what you are trying to do. Absolute right and absolute wrong do not exist. A thing is wrong only because you say it is wrong, and a thing is right for the same reason. Right and wrong, therefore, do not exist as absolutes, but only as momentary assessments of what works and what doesn't work. You make these assessments yourself as individuals and as a society, given what you are wishing to experience and how you see yourself in relationship to everything that is. In the book Friendship with God, he's talking about himself. "I brought the human race a new gospel that would heal the world in two sentences. We are all one. Ours is not a better way. Ours is merely another way." Okay, so you can hear there's lots of error in that page, right? Okay. This book is being marketed to Christian parents as a rap session at a church youth group where teenagers discuss everything they ever wanted to know about life but were too afraid to ask God. So it's being marketed to Christian parents as a good book for Christian teens. Okay, we need to be able to look at these things, even if it's marketed to Christians, and be able to discern what truth is not and what truth is. Obviously, we live in a world filled with faulty reasoning that is disguised as truth. But if you teach your kids or people you know how to discern faulty truth or faulty reasoning, then it's much easier for them not to mistake it for the truth later on. So if you teach kids what error is, they'll know what truth is not, right? You would not believe the stuff I read in Christian books these days. I'm like, are you kidding me right now? What is this junk? And then I'll walk into and it surprises me because Calvary Chapel is pretty conservative. I'll walk into a Calvary Chapel bookstore and see the books there. And I'm like, what? So I always make a note to take the book and go tell the pastor, they love that, of course. Telling them what books they should and shouldn't have in their bookstore. But I've seen Rob Bell in Christian. It kills me. And I'm like, what is this doing here? Anyways, I'll get off my soapbox right now. Okay, so first, truth is not what works. Remember how he talks about, truth is whatever works for you given what you want, okay? Just because what you say gets the desired results, it does not make it true. An example of this would be perjury or lying on the stand. Just because you lie on the stand and you get free doesn't make what you said true. It just means that you lied and got off, you know? So just because you get declared not guilty, it doesn't even mean that you aren't guilty. It just means that you gave the perception, right? But some people will live this way. They'll say, whatever works for me is my truth. But truth isn't what works. So I made these little mnemonic devices. They're little rhymes that help me remember these things. So this one I always say, just because it worked for you doesn't make it true. So just because it worked for you doesn't make it true. So just because you say, oh, but I was only going 60 in a 70 zone and you're really going 85. It doesn't mean that you were actually going 60. It just means you said you were going 60. So just because it works for you, it does not make it true. Second, truth is not what coheres. So just because a system of facts coheres really well doesn't make it true. For example, if you have a story, let's say, and it's Cinderella, right? And you have the glass slipper, and you have the prince, and you have the scullery maid, and you have the stepsisters and the stepmother, and a pumpkin, let's say. You have all these facts, and together they cohere to make this really great story, right? But outside of this system, is that true?
No, it's a bunch of lies.
Well, it's a fairy tale, right? So So it's all true in this system. In the story of Cinderella, yes, there is a pumpkin. Yes, there is a stepmother. There are stepsisters. There is a scullery maid. There's a glass slipper. There's a prince. All of these things, yes, those are true, that those are part of the story of Cinderella. However, Cinderella, just because it's got this great cohering system, does not mean that Cinderella itself is true. So just because you have a system of facts that cohere really well together, it doesn't mean that outside of that system of facts it's true. For example, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, any other religious belief system outside of Christianity, because we believe Christianity is true, just because they have a system of facts that cohere really well, or system of beliefs, doesn't mean that just because they all agree with each other, they're all true.
Well, that's how I think a lot of people got off on the tangent of evolution. It made sense.
Right. I mean, in its system.
There was a bunch of stuff that logically fit together.
Right.
People.
Yep. Right. So if this is all there is in the world, then yes, Cinderella would be absolute truth. But this isn't all there is in the world, right? There is a whole world outside of it. We have external evidence that tells us this is not true. This did not actually happen. Or if it did, not in the fantastic way that the fairy tale portrays. So just because something coheres really well, has a great beginning, middle, and end, ties up really nicely, put a little bow on it, does not mean that it's not true just because it coheres really well. So this one I always say, this one's a long one. Even though Cinderella got her fella because she lost her shoe, it does not make the story true. So just because something coheres, it doesn't mean that it's the truth. Because, again, we have to remember that there are external things outside of this that could be going against it. And we need to look at those.
Can you say that one again?
Huh? Oh, even though Cinderella got her fella because she lost her shoe, it does not make the story true. I love fairy tales. Personally, I think they're a great way to teach people things, but they're just that. They're a story. They're a device to teach morals. They're not the absolute truth. The moral is the absolute truth, not the vehicle it's being portrayed in. That's why I think it's funny when people get all bent out of shape, and don't crucify me for this, about Harry Potter. Because personally, I love books. I'm a huge literary geek. And for me, I look at Harry Potter, it's like the same thing as like Narnia or Lord of the Rings. It's a vehicle. The story is a vehicle to teach a moral. And actually, the moral throughout the books is the hero myth, that self-sacrifice is the ultimate greatest good. And people don't even like see that part. All they see is like, oh, it's witchcraft. I'm like, well, what about the White Witch in Narnia? And what about all the witches and all that in Lord of the Rings? But no one's going after Tolkien or you know, and Lewis, probably just because they're dead and no one can. But like, it's just funny to me because I'm like, no, because what people are missing is that the vehicle is not the truth that we're trying to. The truth is what we're trying to find is the moral in the story. And so I think that when we teach our kids, with my son, you know, I'm very careful when we're watching things. I try to explain, well, you know, because, you know, he's little, so he thinks Power Rangers are real, you know, things like that. So we always talk about, like, you know, okay, you have to remember, like, those are not real, but let's talk about what Tommy, the Red Power Ranger, did and how that is a valuable thing to know. And so that's something that I think that people miss when they're watching things with friends or family or kids. They don't take the opportunity that these stories give them to teach. And I think that we tend to use it just for entertainment. We don't even think about the point behind it. That's why I love Marvel, for example. Marvel is a great example of, they hide these amazing stories, and they use these characters that are very likable, obviously. But, I mean, if you look at the story of Civil War and you look at the Winter Soldier, the Captain America movies, it's a story about big government and how you can use it to talk about what's happening in the world today and abuse of power. And it's like, gosh, it was such a great thing I could use to teach my government students. And so I think we just have to be careful to look beyond the vehicle of the moral and actually just teach the moral instead. So, sorry, that's another tangent of mine. Okay, truth is not good intentions or sincerity. A person can have the best intentions or be completely sincere, but that does not make their statement or action truth. An example of this would be Islamic Jihad or Japanese kamikaze pilots. Oscar Wilde, of all people, said that a thing is not necessarily true because a man dies for it. A person can be sincere and wrong at the same time. So someone could be what? Sincerely wrong, right? Because they may believe something so strongly that they're willing to die for it. It does not make it true, okay? The passion of the follower does not make the actual system true. Just on the opposite side, the failure of the follower does not make the system false, right? So just because we fail to portray Christ the way that we're supposed to does not mean that Christ is to blame for everything that we do wrong. So just because there's evil in the world does not mean that God is to blame. It means we're to blame. Mm-hmm. You know, and but people miss that. And so if we're saying that we can blame God for how bad Christians portray him, well, then we can also say that just because people are passionate, it doesn't mean that the end result is true. So it's the opposite side. This one I say, just because your actions are without wax, it doesn't mean they line up with the facts. So just because your actions are without wax, it doesn't mean they line up with the facts. And the reason I say that is because some people believe that back in the day in ancient Greece, when they would damage statues, like marble statues, they couldn't just glue a piece of marble back on. So what they would do is they would actually take wax pieces and mold it so that it would fit the piece, and they would paint it to look like the rest of the marble. And so when art collectors or people who were determining the value of these things, they would go and they would examine it and they say, okay, this is sincere, meaning it's without wax. It's a sincere piece that has not been fixed or replaced or repaired. Sincerity.
Like genuine.
Uh-huh, genuine, exactly. So just because your actions are without wax or sincere doesn't mean that they line up with the facts. All right. Truth is not what is comprehensive. So Dr. Geisler said, not all long-winded presentations are true and concise ones are false. Just because an idea or a worldview seems to have an explanation that fits the most data, it does not make it true. There are some worldviews out there that have lots and lots of relevant data and comprehensive explanations for things, but they're not true. So, for example, Hinduism, good Lord, they have millions and millions of gods. But just because they have more or it's more comprehensive does not mean that it's true. Just because you have a professor who talks 2 hours about Darwinism doesn't mean Darwinism is true because a creationist gets up for 30 minutes and gives his case. Because it seems like this guy has more information. Well, more information doesn't always mean that it's more true. Sometimes you have more information because they keep having to come up with new explanations to explain things because their first explanation didn't work for for everything. Whereas I think that's why Christianity is so simple, because the one story, it just works for everything. You know, like every single problem we come up against, every single issue we have in the world, we can explain it by the fact that, well, one day in the garden, you know, Adam ate from the fruit, and here we are. Like, you know, I mean, it's really simple, right? But some people don't like Christianity because it's too simple. Some people who are intellectually deep, they're like, I want more than that. I want that. That's too simple for me. It can't be true. It's too simple. You know, all you have to do is accept Jesus into your heart, acknowledge he's a savior, and he rose again. Really, it's not that hard. But people are like, no, it can't. That can't be it. There has to be more. You know, and I think that's why Christianity is so simple, because it's the truth, and truth is simple, right? So this one I say, just because something is complete, it doesn't make it good to eat. So just because something is complete, it doesn't make it good to eat. Okay, this next one is fun. Truth is not what is existentially relevant. Meaning, anything that's existentially relevant is anything we need to exist. So things that are existentially relevant. Are like what? Food, air, water. Say shelter. Okay. These are things that we need to exist. They are relevant to our existence. Okay. This would say Darwinists, materialists, non-Christians, they would say, oh, this is, or not say non-theists. They would say, this is all you need to exist. This is all that matters, basically. If Darwinism is true, this is all that should matter to human beings, right? There should be a survival of the fittest. There should be an ethical egoism, meaning we do whatever we can to get these things, and that's all that matters, right? This is the truth. This is the only thing that we know that can be true, is that humans need these things to survive. And so all that is true is that we need to feed people, we need to make sure they can breathe, we need to make sure they have water, and we need to make sure they have shelter, right? That's all that matters. But this is not all the truth that there is in the world, right? Is 2 plus 2 true? I mean, 2 plus 2 equals 4 true.
That is only like the physical.
Well, really quick, is this true? 2 plus 2 is 4, right? This is the truth, right? Is that relevant to our existence? Could I live my whole life not knowing that 2 plus 2 equals 4? Technically, right? It wouldn't be the greatest quality of life, but I could survive.
Yeah, without
knowing this, right? But this is a truth.
Right.
So not everything, this is not the only truth that there is in the world. So truth is not just what is existentially relevant. There is truth outside of this system. Right? There's theoretical, metaphysical things that are true that don't exist in this. So there's not just the physical, right? There's other things that are true outside of the physical. So truth can't just be determined by what is existentially relevant, what is relevant to us surviving. We could still exist, you know, even if we didn't know that 2 plus 2 equals 4, yes, but this is true, so...
You mean to say then that there could have been one truth, but then a lot of this deception?
What do you mean?
Like, there is one truth. There couldn't be five truths. It should be one.
No, there is
lots of.
There's lots of truth out there. There's
lots of truth. Yeah, I mean, depends on what issues. But right. There, truth is truth. One is truth, but lies and deceit is fabricated, is more.
Well, I mean, I mean, there's lots of both, basically. But see, that's what some people think, like, well, all the truth that you need is in the Bible. Well, yeah, that's true. That's all the truth you need for salvation. But that's not all the truth you need to survive, you know. So there is lots of truth out there. And so we can't just say like, otherwise we'd be just like the Darwinists. The Darwinists say, okay, well, all you need for the only truth that exists is this. If we say the Bible is all you need to exist, well, that's not true, because guess what? We need these things too.
Yeah, but that one is inside the Bible too.
Well, right, but you know, I'm just saying that there is more. There's lots of truth out there, but we have to obviously have something to measure it up against, right? So that's kind of what I'm getting at. Is there's lots of different types of truth, but there has to be something else outside of these systems, whether we determine if that's all there is. There has to be something else. So what we need for life, this is my little rhyme, what we need for life is not all that is true, for we know that 1 + 1 = 2. This is where my little dorky teacher-ness comes in. What we need for life is not all that is true, for we know that 1 + 1 = 2.
I think it was Calvin that said that all truth is God's truth, and it doesn't necessarily have to just be the Bible.
Right.
It's all over.
Exactly. Okay. So, 6, truth is not what feels good, right? The newest wave of pop Christianity that's sweeping America is that truth is what is comfortable, right? People are picking and choosing their worldviews based on what? What feels good
what
to them.
What feels good to person.
Yeah. As Rob Bell says in his book, There Is No Hell, why do churches avoid the difficult topics? The Bible's clear in many areas. There is a hell. Jesus was against homosexuality. Not all religions are the same. But popular preachers don't touch these subjects because they don't want to make anyone feel bad. But guess what? The truth does hurt sometimes. As Dr. Geisler says, bad news is often true. Unless someone's really cruel, they would not come to you and say, your child's been in a car accident, unless it's true, right? So bad news is often true. It's a fact that we live in a fallen world, and that sometimes that which is true does not feel good. If the truth was always good, then no one would ever lie, but we know that's not the case, right? So if the truth was always the best thing, if it always made us feel good, then what, we would always tell the truth, right?
Truth sets you free, even if it hurts. But facing it,
right,
and other than facing a lie, that is double jeopardy.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Excuse me, I missed number 5. What was number 5?
Truth is not what is existentially relevant.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Obviously, just because something gives you a quiver in your liver or a burning in your bosom, it does not make it true. So it's funny, when we talk about Mormonism, I'll show you guys the verse in the book in Mormon that basically says, like, if you ask me if something's true and then you get a burning in your bosom, then you know that it is. And it's like, wait a minute. So
it's like playing with fire, not the burn.
Yeah. Feelings are subjective and they can lie. That's why it's incredibly important to be anchored in the absolute truth of Scripture, so that you'll not be tossed to and fro on a sea of subjective feelings. So obviously, truth is not just what feels good. Truth sometimes hurts. And that's one of the things that people are like, gosh, but, you know, the Bible is so restrictive, and you know, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. And I'm like, you know what? Look, it's not always fun. It's not always easy. But it's the truth. And that's why I follow it, even if it doesn't feel good sometimes. And so you have to decide, would you rather feel good and happy all the time and know you're believing a lie, or would you rather believe the truth and occasionally have heartache because of it? And so you have to ask people, like, where would you rather be? And if they would really believe the lie to feel good, then they're not ready for the hardness of what it is to be a Christian in the world we live in today.
They're ready to go home.
So this one says, just because something gives you a delight, it does not always make it right. So just because something gives you a delight, it does not always make it right.
Not all the glitters are gold.
Right, exactly.
Truth can still be, though, what feels good.
Well, yeah, truth can feel great, you know, if it's a good one.
Yeah, right. It's a real truth, not a halfway or a schematic truth. It's, I mean,
you know, I mean, people always ask me, like, what's the one thing you struggle with as a Christian? And for me, it's the problem of evil. Like, I look at the world and I'm like, I don't understand why God just doesn't help. why he doesn't just fix things, you know. But obviously there's a truth that I don't understand that is bigger than me, and it doesn't feel good to follow it, but because it's the truth, I'm going to. Some there are some things that are true that are great and happy, and the fact that Jesus died for us and rose again on the third day, and now we get to spend forever with him. I mean, that's a great one, right? That feels great. but we can't determine what truth is by how it feels. So definitions of truth, we talked about what truth is not. This is what truth is. Okay. Truth is correctly defined as that which corresponds to reality or that which conforms to the facts. So a statement needs to line up with reality or with the way things actually are in order to be considered truth. So for example, when I say I have black hair, you can verify that I am lying because it does not line up with the way things actually are, right? There are things that we can learn through our senses. There's three different ways we can learn what truth is. One is evidence of sense. Which is what? Using your eyes, ears, nose, taste buds to tell you, your senses, this is true, this is not true. You can use your eyes to determine that I am not black-haired. You can say, nope, that's not true. The second one is let me think for a second.
Evidence of sense.
Basically the scientific method. There's another name for it. I can't think of off the top of my head, but basically it's a scientific method. Having a hypothesis, determining if it's true, and testing it, experimenting. If you can test something and determine its veracity, its truthfulness, then you can verify it as truth. Third is moral testimony. Basically, if someone who is proven to be morally valor, someone who you know is a truth teller, says something happened, then you can probably say, okay, yeah, that's probably true. Obviously, we use all of these in court cases today to build a case, right? So we use evidence of sense, like someone saw a mugging happen. So that's what, you know, their eyes or someone, you know, their purse is stolen. That's a fact. Scientific method, we have ways of determining using DNA and all those types of things, determine whether someone was actually at the scene. Experimentation. And then we also have moral testimony, right? You have to have two eyewitnesses to determine whether something actually happened in court or not, right? And then you have a jury that decides whether or not this is enough to make your case for you. But these are three different ways where you can determine whether or not a belief or a statement lines up with the truth.
So moral testimony, that has to have two witnesses?
Well, in a court case today, moral testimony has to have two witnesses. But let's say that you have a friend that you know is always tells the truth, and they're very, very trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And there's just one of them, and they say this happened. Well, then you'll probably believe them. Because they
know.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right. So it's not, it doesn't always have to be two people. Just in an official court case, it has to be two. So truth is that which corresponds to reality or that which conforms to the facts. How do we find out what truth is? We use these things to decide if the statement conforms to the truth.
The statement or the claims are true.
We use different ways, different methods, to determine whether or not a statement lines up with reality, right? So if these things are checked off, then we can say, yes, that is true, that did happen, that does line up with reality. That does line up with what actually happened. So, but when we talk about how Jesus answered Pilate, how did he answer Pilate? He didn't say, oh, well, truth is that which corresponds to the facts. And you have to use these different things in order to figure out what truth is. No, what did he say? He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me, John 14:6. So Jesus is the answer to Pilate's question. Jesus is truth, right? So we can take everything that Jesus says, and we can say, yes, we can verify that what Jesus says is truth. The word is truth, John 17:6, and God is truth. So externally, we have all of these evidences that we're going to go over throughout the semester. We're going to go over the evidence that God exists, the evidence that Jesus is God, and the evidence that Christianity is the best worldview. The Bible is the word of God. We'll use these things to determine those. These are what you determine external evidence with. But internally, Jesus gave Pilate the answer. The internal evidence would be, so this is external evidence, and internal evidence would be, what does the Bible say about itself? Or what does Jesus say about himself? And you can take the Bible, Jesus, God, and interchange those. So what does Christianity say about itself? It says Jesus is truth, the word is truth, and God is truth. So the trippy thing about this is that truth is that which corresponds to reality. So if you take this word, you cross it out, you put God or Jesus or the Bible, I always say those are what your reality needs to correspond to. God is that which corresponds to reality. Jesus is that which corresponds to reality. The Bible, these things are our reality. They're real. Internally, again, we'll talk about externally later, but for the end purposes, you know, this is the reality that we need to conform to. So Ephesians 4:20-24 says, if indeed you have heard him, the Messiah, and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to the former manner of life, you lay aside your old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, and that you may be renewed in the spirit of your mind and put on a new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. So it's right there, Ephesians 4:20-24 talks about, look, if you've heard Jesus, you've been taught by him, then you know the truth is in Jesus, and that you need to put off your old self and you need to conform or correspond to what the actual truth is. So this definition fits really well within the Christian worldview. It's also very, very old, the correspondence, that's called the correspondence view of truth. This is what Christians would consider our definition of truth, the correspondence view. It's Aristotle, talked about it in his book Metaphysics. It's been around a long time. So if people are like, oh, you know, you guys just came up with that. No, actually, it dates back to the Greek philosophers with all the other systems of truth, you know, because people like to say, oh, Christians are just finding these things and using them, coming up with these new ideas. And it's like, well, no, the correspondence view of truth has been around for thousands of years, and Aristotle used it. So, and that's when it was first really kind of formulated.
But a lot of times, like evil works, you know, they use the name of Jesus for kind of, you know, because of...
Well, yeah, because everyone wants a piece of Jesus.
Yes.
And it's interesting because that's one of the most interesting things when we talk about other religions. They all want a piece of him. They all have something about Jesus in their religion,
uh-huh,
because there's something special about that man.
Mm-hmm. There is the truth.
Right.
There is the truth.
Right. They're attracted to the truth, you know, but they don't know that that's what that is. They're attracted to something.
But they don't want to believe it, you know.
Right. Right.
They just want to be deceived.
Right.
So the correspondence view of truth is what you drew.
Truth is that which corresponds to reality.
Okay. It's real.
Or truth is that which conforms to the facts.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it's that statement you gave us at the very beginning.
Yes, that's the definition of truth, is the correspondence view. Truth is that which conforms to the facts. Truth is that which conforms to, if these are facts, then truth is which conforms to these things. So then next, really quickly, I'm going to cover the laws of logic, because I think that they go very well with truth. The laws of logic basically say no two opposite statements can be true at the same time and in the same sense. Meaning, if we're talking about
when there are two conflicting reports or something, there's got to be one
that's true. And it could be neither of the things that the people are saying. It could be something else completely that happened.
But as long as there is evidence, that external blah, blah, evidence, you know. Mm-hmm.
So laws of logic basically say no two opposite statements can be true at the same time in the same sense. That is the whole point of having laws of logic, is so that people don't make conflicting statements. The laws of logic are also called first principles due to their foundational nature. So it's funny, because a lot of times what happens is people can go their whole life and never learn these first principles. And they'll be out there making a case for something, and they'll have no idea how to properly make a case, or even to understand that what they're doing is using logic. And so I think that we really need to do better at teaching our young kids laws of logic. So the nature of these laws is that they are undeniable. They are laws that flow from God's nature. God is logical. God is ordered. God is not chaotic. He's not conflicting. He's not contradictory. He does not change. The Lord do not change. We have the laws of logic that we do in the world. Things make sense because God is a sensible creator. So they're self-evident to all, meaning you cannot get behind, under, or beyond them. There are some things that nobody can deny, you know, and they will try to, but they're self-evident. When if you take a majority census, you'll get whatever the actual truth is. They're like ethical laws, which are prescriptive, what you ought to do. So in the Bible, well, I guess say in life, there are things that are prescriptive and things that are descriptive. What is descriptive? What does descriptiveness do?
It describes your maybe behavior, attitude.
It describes, right?
Uh-huh.
It describes
what is, right?
Prescriptive is what?
Following what's order. It's an order.
Well, when you go to the doctor and
there's a prescription, the order.
They prescribe something, right?
Prescription, yeah.
These prescribe
what to do or what to. What ought to do?
Yeah, or what ought to be, or just what ought.
Okay.
So, descriptive is basically just describing what is happening. So, in the Bible, when you look at narrative, like when you have like the book of Ruth or the book of Joshua, and you're looking at narrative history, they're simply describing what is happening, right? They're not giving moral prescriptions. They're not saying, David slept with Bathsheba, so you should do the same thing, right? So, like, a lot of times I think it's funny because people will take these examples in the Bible and say, oh, look at the patriarchs, man, they were terrible people. Look what Abraham did. Look at what David did. Yeah, you're right. Look at Solomon. That guy was an idiot until he asked for wisdom. And even then, we're not sure. But morally, these people were not exemplary. Okay? They were not the people you want to look up to. But the whole point is not that we should look at their behavior as what we ought to do, but look at them as this is what is, and look how God used them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but there are places in the Bible that prescribe what ought to be. For example, what? Ten Commandments, right? Or what? The Gospels. Jesus preaches. This is what you ought to do. Or the epistles. This is what you ought to do. Though we have to look at everything in context, of course. So you have descriptive, describing what is, and you have prescriptive, describing what, prescribing what ought to be. So like ethical laws, meaning morals, are what ought to be, right? Ethical laws, or, and then this is truth, sorry. Truth is descriptive, what is. Morals are prescriptive, what ought to be. Ethical laws are prescriptive, okay? What you ought to do. Same with logical laws. Logical laws are what ought to be. You ought to think in this way. They're first principles to how you... you can argue that they're also descriptive, but the world, honestly, people aren't always logical. They should be logical, but they're not always. So it's also a negative test for truth. Meaning, if you can determine what's illogical, what you can determine what is logical, right? So the four main ones that I think are the most important are these four. The law of non-contradiction, basically stating that A cannot be both A and non-A at the same time in the same sense. Meaning, I cannot be me and also not be me in the same time in the same sense, which means that I do exist. I can't also not exist at the same time, right? I either exist or I don't exist. They can't both be true. So, law of identity, A is A, right? If something shares all of the same qualities, characteristics as something else, if they're exactly the same, then they identify with each other, right? A is A. I use this argument when I talk about abortion. Because a lot of people will say, well, it's my body. I get to decide what happens with it. Well, according to the law of identity, it's actually not your body, because what's in your body has a completely different DNA than you. Therefore, they're not the same. They don't identify with each other. Therefore, it's not the same thing. So you can't say it's my body because it's not your body. It's got a whole separate DNA than you. So when emotional... when emotional and theological arguments don't work, then you got to go logical with people, right? The law of excluded middle. A is either A or non-A. There's no other choice. Either this is true or it's not true. There's no gray area in between. Either I stole the purse or I didn't. If I hadn't, she'd still have her purse. It either happened or it didn't happen. And then the law of rational inference. If A is in B and B is in C, then A is in C. So this one I like to use picture because... If A is in B and B is in C, mm-hmm. then A is also in C.
Makes sense.
So you can infer things by other things. So if all you had was that A is in B and B is in C, you could say, therefore... A is in C. You can infer things without actually having all the information. You can find truth without having every single piece, which is how we construct a lot about the New Testament and the writers. And, we say if Paul was here at this point and he wrote this in this epistle, he's probably talking about this. And so we can make rational, meaning logical inferences based on things. We can discern facts by pulling, using our senses to determine what's true. So an example of an argument, if you looked under one of these things, like I just said, if A, which is, I'll just write if A and A is this, and or if A is in B and B is in C, therefore, A is in C. So this is what we call a argument, a syllogism in logic. So this would be an example of a syllogism.
You can address, like, C, if C is in B and B is in A,
Yeah, then C would be an A. Yeah.
C would still be an A.
Well, not. It depends. You can only go one way usually.
Oh, because the A is more inner.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Either so can
you're
be go, those two, but
going,
C cannot be inside,
right?
Okay, gotcha.
Yes. So this would be an example of a syllogism. So premise one, you always have two premises, premise one, premise two, and then a conclusion. So you have premise one. If A is in B, premise two, and B is in C, conclusion, then A is in C. So an example of this with God would be premise one, the objective laws of logic exist. The objective laws of logic are usually there's not so much in the middle, but just to give an example, they're metaphysical laws, meaning you can't go like pick it up. Like I can't go pick up the law of excluded middle. It's something that is beyond the physical. They're transcendent. They're beyond us, and they preexisted mankind. They were around before us. How do we know that? Because we're all born with them. That's how we know. We're all born with this idea of logic and that there is something right and something that fits and something that doesn't fit. Like when you get an answer right on a test or when you get an answer right and you're like, oh, that fits. It's like a puzzle falling into place. It's like, oh, it feels good. You know, we all have this idea that there is something that we need to fit. Something needs to fit. Premise two, all conceptual laws reflect the mind of a lawgiver. So if we have these laws, if they exist, if these types of laws reflect the mind of a lawgiver, then the best and most reasonable explanation for the kind of mind necessary for the existence of the transcendent objective medical physical laws of logic is God. So if we have laws of logic, then we have what? A God that created the laws of logic, right? A logical God that put them there. And that little triangle is, it's the symbol for therefore. Therefore. So when I'm writing shorthand sometimes, I'll just put that in when I'm writing therefore. But a full, and sometimes you'll have, like, more than two premises. Sometimes you'll have, like, a third or fourth premise in here. When you're using simple ones, you're not going to need that many. It's only when you get into, like, super deep philosophy and logic that you start adding, like, three, four, and five premises. But a typical syllogism is two premises and a conclusion. An example of this would be... next week, I'll give you a bunch of them. We talk about the existence of God. But, obviously, that works. If the laws of logic exist, there must be... if there's a universal moral law, let's see, what is it? Trying to think of that syllogism. Universal moral laws. That's the second premise. There is a universal moral law. Oh, moral law means moral lawgiver. And we'll talk about this more next week. I'm just doing an example. So, if there is a universal moral law, basically, universal moral law means moral lawgiver. Because something can't be universal unless somebody put it all in our heads in the beginning, basically. It wouldn't be universal unless it was there from the start. So universal moral law means moral lawgiver. We do have universal moral laws, therefore there is a universal moral lawgiver. So this would be an example of using the moral law in order to explain the existence of God, which I'll give you a bunch of those next week. But
that's a great point that Lewis brings out. In
yes. And that, okay, so the reason I like Lewis is not because... is that he gives a great, great case for premise two that he talks about. And it's not even just in Mere Christianity, but I think it's the abolition of man. The abolition of man, he gives a list of laws throughout different countries that are exactly the same. And he talks about why would all these countries have all the same laws if universal moral laws didn't exist. And so he gives a great... So what you'll learn is as you're reading, you'll find pieces of evidence or statements that might help this premise, that might help this premise. So basically what we do as apologists is when we're reading, we have these ideas in our head about these cases for God. And so what we do is when we read, we find different things like, oh, that's a great statement that proves this. Or that's a great statement that proves this. And then that's when you start getting all these little things in between. Because you not only have to have two premises and a conclusion, you have to be able to prove both your premises. You can't just throw premises out there and say, oh yeah, universal moral law means moral law giver. Well, great, but you have to prove that. And you can't just say universal moral laws exist, you have to prove that they exist. And then, only and only then, can you prove your conclusion. So that's why, even though we have all these great arguments as Christians, we never stop studying, because we always want to strengthen our premises. Always. We want to have the best stuff out there as Christians. And we have great stuff. And so we should utilize it. Lastly, if you want to know more about these types of things and you want to kind of start easy, there's two really great books. The Fallacy Detective, it's technically for kids, but it's a great book for adults who are just starting out. It's basically 38 lessons on how to recognize bad reasoning. And it's got this little dog that kind of looks like, what's that, the police dog? I can't remember his name. He's like a hound. He was like, I don't know. Anyways. And then you've got Come Let Us Reason by Norman Geisler and Ronald Brooks. And that's going to be probably the next step. So this one is on how to recognize bad reasoning, and that one teaches you how to reason. So that one teaches you how to have logical arguments, how to put together a syllogism, what a syllogism is, what it means to take the roof off an argument. Like I said, when you kind of just take someone's argument and you're like, this is what you're actually saying, and it doesn't make sense. That's kind of when you take a roof off. Or like when you commit verbal suicide, it's when you say something like, oh, truth is unknowable. Well, wait a minute, you just, is that true? Come Let Us Reason teaches you all about those different things that you can learn.
Who's the author on The Fallacy Detective?
Blue Dorn. B, it's like their brothers, I think, or father and son, but BLUEDORN. But those are great starter books for this topic. So... And when I used to take this class, I took logic at Bible College, and I had a professor that would make us basically just like, whatever we were reading, we had to look for arguments and constantly practice. What's the premise one? What's the premise two? What's the conclusion? What's the author trying to say? And so I got really good at it just because he made us do it constantly with everything that we read. So it's not like, it seems intimidating at first, but once you start kind of thinking in that mindset, then you actually start reading in that mindset, and then you're like, oh, the author's saying this, he's saying because of this and because of this you have this. So and then that helps you recognize faulty argument, right? Because then you can be like, oh, he's saying this and he's saying this, and so he's saying that, wait, that doesn't follow, that doesn't make sense, he didn't prove his first two premises. You get that a lot when you're reading like atheists or like people who are writing about science. They'll like say these things, and so then it sounds like this nice tight syllogism, because they'll say these things and they'll be like, therefore, and you're like, oh, they made a really good case, and you're like, wait a minute, they didn't prove their first two premises. There is no God, therefore this, therefore there's no God, and you're like, wait a minute, what? And then you learn things like circular reasoning, where people say, oh, well, I believe that Darwinism is true because Darwin said so. And I believe that Darwin is true because Darwinism said so, or this and that. And so you kind of learn how to see what people are thinking and if they're actually making a good case or not. Super helpful as you go forward.
Now, with the inferences, that would be inductive thinking, right? And then this, with the syllogisms, would be deductive.
Yes. Okay, so in there, yes. So inductive would be more like... I always use Sherlock. Sherlock is deductive. Sherlock Holmes is looking at all the evidence, and he's saying, okay, because of this, this, and this,
then this is my
then name. This is, yeah, you know, this is the case. So he actually does inference with deductive reasoning. Inductive would be more like,
if I strike a match and it lights, and I strike a second one and it lights, and I do it to the 9 matches, the 10th match I'm going to inductively say this is also...
Yeah, maybe based on experimentation more. Mm-hmm. Because with deductive, you're really just mostly using your brain to make the connections. But I would say that definitely, rational inference would be both. Any other questions? That's actually a good one. If you want to get your, like, thinking skills, we're working along the idea of logic, and I always like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, like the old Sherlock Holmes. Like, I try to read him and figure out what happened at the end before, like, I read, you know, what happens actually. And then obviously the show is really good too, but it helps with your deductive thinking. It really, really is a great exercise. Any other questions?
Did you say Sherlock Holmes deductive?
Yeah, he's deductive, yeah. Oh, you know what? Actually, really quickly before we end, there is one thing that I want to show you guys. So I'm going to shut the...